talked about here is what I wrote about in the letter. I mean, I can only extrapolate, I don't know what was in the minds mm-hmm. of the decision makers who said, let's bring an IVS to Laos. Probably no one will ever know. I mean, even if they told you, you wouldn't necessarily believe them. But basically, I mean, I think, that's how Don, who I love Don as a person, but I just think he's got this crazy, that letter of his was like crazy to me because it's like, okay, the United States government makes a major commitment of money and resources and bombing, airplanes, CIA. They're going to not let the communists take over Laos. They're going to fight a war. They're willing to drop more bombs on Laos than they did on the entire Pacific theater in World War II. And Laos is only part of the base. Obviously, Vietnam was the key to this effort. Now, there's a war going on, and there are people going. There's a huge effort is made to build the world's biggest air base and not let any reporters go. Air Force men are brought into Laos and put into civilian clothing, and fake identities are created for them. And this is huge, this huge pro-war effort. This was a war effort. It was a war effort. And IVS was part of that war effort, whether it was an afterthought or pre-thought or pro-thought or whatever the thought was. It was, once it got there, we were at the AID compound, which had the military, assistance group or whatever over there too, giving out, arms and material and all that. And it was all part of the same thing. And whether or not, so many volunteers managed to build so many schools somewhere, to me, it has always seemed like a secondary issue. When I was living in Lahanam for 6 weeks, the AID official there was named Tony Babb. And I don't remember if there were any other IVSers there, but the story at Lahanam was pretty much the same anywhere. They would have an AID person there. Now, if you are an IVS volunteer living in Lahanam in that situation, you're worried the Pathet Lao might kill you. So when you go out to such and such a village to build a school or to do something, and the villagers say, the Pathet Lao were here last night, or, the Pathet Lao are in that village, or, we don't like the Pathet Lao are doing this, or whatever it might be, you came back and told Tony Babb, not because you were a spy, but because that's what you talked about. You were part of the war. Why wouldn't you? You weren't against the Pathet Lao. You were against the Pathet Lao in the first place. You didn't like them. They were trying to, they were potentially going to kill you. You were part of this effort. And then, every time I was with Tony Babb one time when we drove in, because he was my transportation, in from Lahanam into Savannakhet. And I went and did my thing, and then we were going to meet at 3 in such a place, and we meet at 3 in such a place, Jeep, with the wife, and then we drive to the CIA compound. And I'm sitting in the Jeep, and Tony is going in to talk to the CIA people. Not because he was CIA, maybe he was, but because, he wanted to find out from the CIA people what's going on, and, is the road safe between here and Lahanam, or, they're buddies, and they're asking him, he's their eyes and ears. So, it's all, and if that was true in a place like Lahanam, you can only imagine what it was like with that idiot Fred, whatever his name is, up in Ban Hui Sai with Tony Poe, who, had become this, he was not a bad guy when he first came out there, but by the end of his tour, he was this fanatic anti-communist fellow, Fred, I forget his name, he's a real strange guy. Kind of preppy and overexcited and just overdramatic. Any isolated area in particular, like a place like that, or where Tony Poe, there wasn't even an AID person. I mean, there were AID people there, but Tony Poe was in charge of the show openly. It was this big CIA guy. IVS, obviously there was part of, was directly, you could say, was part of the CIA. In a place like Lahanam, I would just say they were independently. But the CIA was running the show, and IVS was a part of the overall picture. And, that's the fundamental reality. Yeah. And within that context, yes, we built schools. I mean, Hitler built trains or something, you know. But
Mussolini made the trains run on time.
Well, I mean, Hitler got built trains.
Yeah, right? Well, he did, yes.
I mean, lots of good things happened. Stalin did a lot of great things for Russia, I guess. So, not that I'm comparing, I'm just saying the fact that, I mean, I was talking to Junie, I don't want to argue with people. I'm, you know, venting on you, because supposedly it's a whole issue. But, yeah. I mean, the fact that schools got built and villagers were grateful, you know, is true. And IBS was part of this war effort. And I don't think, you know, that I mean, if somebody wants to be part of the war effort, fine, we can debate that. But this whole, what gets me is this whole thing of, oh, we're all volunteers, you know, helping people, you know, isn't this wonderful? I mean, let's call a spade, you know. And IVS was not in Laos to build schools. It may have built schools as a side project. It was in Laos as part of a counterinsurgency effort that included AID and IVS giving cover to CIA personnel. Instead of having to say, I work for the CIA, they could say, I work for CIA, AID or IVS in certain areas. It was there because building schools and so forth is a source of intelligence when you're in the middle of a war effort. And hopefully, you know, what passed for a good guy with an AID, a John Paul Vann type, was, oh, well, this way we'll show we can do more for the villagers than the communists, because we'll build schools and they can't or something. Now, in retrospect, I may say that you know, I was quite disappointed when I went back to Laos. I thought the path of Laos were great when I was there, and I think a war brings out the best in them. But I think once the war is over, as apparently has happened in Vietnam as well, you know, that first of all, I think having to fight that kind of war turns you into your paranoid Stalinist type anyway. And then you get done with the war, and you know, you become corrupt, and on and on and on. So I have nothing good to say about the path of Laos right now, personally. I don't know much about them. I have plenty of things bad to say. My overall judgment would be that they're probably, you know, marginally better than if the Royal Laos government had won. Because at least they are, you know, when I was there, they were making efforts to keep prostitution out of Laos. They were making some efforts to, you know, I mean, some development was going on and so forth. But basically, you know, everybody's out to line their pockets and all the rest of it. So they're marginally better. You know, although I guess there's an argument, you know, if you believe in capitalist development for Laos, it might be more accelerated. You know, but on the other hand, if we hadn't gotten involved, I mean, they're all going capitalist anyways. If we hadn't gotten involved, they would have gone capitalist in 65. They would have taken over and gone capitalist starting in 65 instead of waiting till 85. So all we did was actually slow down our own, you know, quote, capitalist goal by 20 years. But all I'm saying is I think if my view is based on Laos, is that if a volunteer group is going to be part of a counterinsurgency effort, that the volunteers should be told that, the world should be told that, the media should be told that, fine. You know, be proud of what you're doing. Don't, you know, I mean, it killed people. You know, I don't like that. And I don't think we should have. I think, obviously, the reason they were keeping it quiet, or one of the reasons they were keeping it quiet, is that that wouldn't have been very popular. That wouldn't have been seen as a good idea by a lot of people. So that is, you know, it's pretty anti-democratic. What you're trying to do is keep. Now, the excuse was that, oh, you know, that had nothing to do with trying to keep the secret from the American people. It all had to do with the, you know, Laos was neutral and the Russians were doing it in the North, so we had to do it and all the rest of it. But then you get into the whole issue of should we have been in Southeast Asia in the first place, which I don't think we should have been. And once you make that fatal error, everything else, you just get, you know, it's like the tar baby, everything gets more and more corrupt, and this was just part of it. But I think you have, I think IVS Laos is fundamentally a sick operation, and the reason was that A, it was part of the war effort, and B, it wasn't acknowledged. It was pretended it was something different. And I don't think that's good, in my view.
Did Don indicate to you that he ever, you know, in all the years you've known him, that I know there are differences, and we've discussed them briefly about IVS Vietnam, IVS Laos, but I'm just wondering whether, since the same people are running the show, that is, IVS headquarters is doing the same thing in Vietnam that they're doing in Laos. They're being paid by the same people. The personnel are rather different to a certain extent in Vietnam. And the conditions that they're facing in Vietnam are considerably different. And one of our challenges is going to be to understand how, whether there is or is not any difference.
Well, I would argue there was two profound differences, one structural and one personal. The personal one that absolutely can't be overemphasized. I mean, you cannot, there is no IVS Vietnam. There's Don Luce. You cannot underemphasize, and whatever he's doing right now, in those years, he was my hero. I mean, I know a lot about Don Luce. No one talked about IVS Vietnam. It was always Don Luce, the volunteers, the media. I mean, Don just happens to be this unique guy who was basically very anti-war. I'm not sure when he started becoming anti-war. But he played this unique role. If somebody else had become the head of IVS Vietnam, or a conservative person, then I would say IVS Vietnam probably would have wound up pretty much like IVS Laos. But, you know, so that's the personal side of it. And Don was an anti-war person, took the thing over, got his Gene Stoltzfus's in, and basically, I mean, I didn't have time to get into the whole story with him. Obviously, you should, but you know, this pivotal thing when he threatened to resign and had his whole team, and he presented Arthur Gardner with a fait accompli. The structural thing that I don't think you can overemphasize, is the role of the media. In Vietnam, the media was everywhere, and Don Luce was an automatic story. So he had an independent power base from AID, from the CIA, from the military, from anybody. He was a figure. He was a historical figure. And reporters would quote him. And you know, there's an enormous amount of stuff on the record that Don did, the tiger cages. You know, you just quote, I mean, you know, he when Hubert Humphrey came to Laos, Don Luce would meet with him. I mean, Don was on every VIP's tour. Mm-hmm. You know, he just was this. So he had an independent power base that was not there in Laos. There was nobody, I mean, I was isolated. I had not a single friend or supporter, even a guy like Art Stillman, who was pretty much probably anti-war. But he was a careerist. He was seeing IVS as, you know, he was going to get some big job at AID or something. I don't know what. He was married to a Thai, so that was all very important to him. So he stayed away from me with a 10-foot pole because I was threatening his career. Whereas there were a lot of guys like me in Vietnam running around, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don Ronk, I don't know if Don Ronk was IVS, I think he was. Carl Strock, probably, if he was serious leftist types. And so the thing was fundamentally different. Whereas in Laos, first of all, the only reporter there that I know of who was based there was this guy Tommy Arbuckle, who was more right-wing than, you know, Arthur Gardner. We didn't have a liberal press. The liberal press would come through, but they didn't know anything about it. There was no power base. There was no source of support. I mean, you know, I was like, you know, I really felt very isolated there. And I felt, you know, especially when I started all my post-IVS stuff, I felt like, you know, I could be killed at any moment. It was just like a totally different atmosphere. At least in Vietnam, I mean, Don had to worry about getting killed, but if he got killed, you know, there'd be a hoo-ha. I mean, he always had, that was his fundamental, you know, source of security, that, you know, they wouldn't kill him because they'd get, you know, it was me. I mean, you know, who the hell would have known who Fred Brownfield was? I mean, nobody would have cared or known.
Do you think that also that in Laos, everyone, you say was, the IVS was much more dependent on, IVS was much more dependent on, you say, for their actual operations in Laos?
I don't know if they couldn't. They couldn't have been more. I mean, they were flying the same airplanes in Vietnam, but it was so much more open in Vietnam. I mean, media was flying the airplane. Yeah, in that sense, I mean, it was just such a tight relationship. You know, we're I mean, in Vietnam, yeah, I mean, but everybody was kind of flying the airplane. They couldn't kick you. I flew airplanes in Vietnam. They couldn't really kick you off or anything.
Well, the IVSID was supposed to get you a ride, yeah. You know, on any military aircraft, not just aircraft. Okay, let's look. There's some questions that have popped up out of this that I'd like to address, and maybe you can clarify them. Just first, and it's just a technical point, the folk you worked with in education, those individuals you mentioned, they were USAID folk.
Which?
Andrews.
Yeah, the whole point was that Andrews was the head of AID Education.
Education, right. That's just a clarify Paul was second, yeah. That's right, all. Right. Yeah, that was clear. The other thing, one thing you mentioned, and it's been mentioned somewhere before, and somehow we're going to have to track down the evidence, and there is evidence. I mean, USAID records are available, and we might be able to find some answers here. But the idea of any CIA operative carrying IVS credentials.
What I was told was that, I can't remember who told it. The guy you go to go talk to is Ron, the famous Ron Rickenback, or Ron Reidenauer. Ron Reidenauer is the Mila guy, right?
Yes, right.
Ron Rickenbeck.
Okay, because I know Ron.
Yeah.
So that's, I know Ron Reidenauer, yes. Right. In fact, I'll see him in about 2 weeks.
Ron Rickenbeck, he's a great guy. I mean, he was a source of a lot of information that became public. And to his credit, I mean, he was AID, but he was really plugged into this world, and he could tell you some IVS stuff. Mm-hmm. It may have been him, maybe it was. I heard that people would claim to be IVS, whether they had I don't even know if I had an IVS credential the whole time I was there. I don't think, was there an IVS volunteer card? I don't even know.
No, there was in Vietnam, but that doesn't mean that there was.
But any real specifics, I actually made that charge without any evidence, to be honest. It was hearsay.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You got to remember, most of the action was out with the RD folks, which I didn't have very much to do with them. Mm-hmm. I was this, you know, anomaly.
Well, that's the next thing, and this is just, hearsay is okay. I mean, hearsay as hearsay is fine. But there's also a lot of claims that the Cluster Village program was really a kind of the Laotian version of Strategic Hamlet to the extent that they could actually do it, which was they couldn't. So instead what they did is they put essentially three-man cells of IVS into these villages. And what I have found is that they were issued radios, two-way radios, but of course that was for evac. If they had medical evacuations, they would need that. When things look bad, USAID would distribute weapons. And I remember one person we interviewed kind of looked at me like, a weapon? In other words, I'm a brethren, you know.
Right.
What am I supposed to do here? But on the other hand, if Pavlov come running through the village shooting everyone, including us,
right.
You know, what are we going to do? And of course, in Vietnam, that was common. That is, that issue had to be faced up front. You had to decide whether you want to kill or be killed, and that was a decision everyone had to make. John Balaban struggled with that a lot. And but what I noticed in these villages is first is they were doing the same things that IVS or any voluntary agency does, in the sense that they're isolated workers who have a project, like pigs or chickens or water wheels, and they just did those jobs, and they all told themselves that, yeah, there's a civil war going on. But for God's sakes, we're all the way out here. Let's just like you get swept up in doing the job. And all these other things that U.S., in fact, most of the interview things, did you have any contact with USAID? And it's like hardly any. I got my supplies from them. But otherwise, they were non-existent. In their lives, they got transportation. They got PX, you know, commissary access, and they had to because they couldn't. They couldn't bring their money into a little village. It would destroy the economy of the village. So what I'm beginning to see is that most people, no matter what they felt when they got there, that they just wanted to get their job done, even though they had an increasing feeling that the job they were doing was a lot less effective or meaningful than they thought it was. And in fact, in some cases, counterproductive. Some of the education people felt, as you just mentioned before, why the hell are we teaching these people English? You know, what is the point of this? And one of them remarked, the point of it was that they'd be the first people killed because they'd be identified with Western influence and American governmental activity. And so you're creating your own hit list, you know, in country. if you weren't, you know, if that's going to happen, you're responsible for it. And I ask some, and I'll ask you later. You know, in 75, you know, when Laos became a communist country, what was your feeling? We'll go back to that. But one of the things I'll probably want to contact you later, I'll send you some stuff and ask you to comment on it. And because I don't think the research, a lot of it is hearsay about IBS, USAID, and the war in the North. A lot of it's hearsay, and a lot of it isn't very accurate. There is an article written that describes the Cluster Village program as simply a counterinsurgency program, and that the people who did it may have not wanted to do that sort of thing, but they did it. And I would argue that, yeah, in the big picture, the way you have framed it, they are. There's no question about it. Why else are they there? Why is USAID paying the freight? Why are they maintaining these lines of supply? Oh, yeah. It's useful. It's doing work for the goals of the United States. But the people who are doing it weren't doing it the way advisory team would be doing it in Vietnam or anywhere right. else. And that produces a lot of complexity. And part of this interview process.
Can we talk about the forward area team?
That's the thing that I want to talk about. Yeah. Because and, of course, Pop Buell, too. I don't think anybody in the United States, I mean, there must be a handful of us who know who he is or who would recognize him. You recognize him right away when you went up to the that right. airlift with Wolf.
Well,
you know those people. It's like I knew William Colby without ever knowing him. Right. The first time I was in a room with him, I knew that was William Colby. There wasn't any doubt about right. it in my mind. And I think most people don't realize that that the Northern, certainly the Northern operation was a completely different thing whatsoever. And I'm really interested about Pop Buell, I mean, as IBS, that is, how did IBS get translated into that direct an involvement, or really was it after Buell left IBS, really? What was your impression?
I don't remember that anymore. My impression was after he left.
It was after he left, yeah.
Well, I don't know, I mean, he met Von Powell, and the whole operation, I remember, started while he was with IBS.
But then he would anyway, since Von Powell was making himself a player. So he would have to be a factor.
Right.
But I want to follow up with that as we go along, because it's obviously a key issue, but we haven't gone deep enough in the research to flesh out that particular issue. What I'd like to talk about now, since we still need some work on the IBS, you accumulated a lot of knowledge about Laos after you left IBS.
Right.
And you mentioned that when you finished with IBS, you went off to Paris to see if somehow you could get some leverage to get into Pathet Lao territories. What happened there?
That was just one of the more ridiculous phases of my life. It was a total disaster. I show up, and can you imagine that a bushy-haired American wearing a black Viet Cong costume shows up in Paris speaking French and Laotian and English, asking to go to Pathet Lao, and I had a letter from like Howard Zinn and Dave Dellinger or something. But, you know, they didn't take me seriously at all. I never even got near the Pathet Lao. I talked to one guy who supposedly knew them, and he just took one look at me, you know, and I was earnestly. So I just fucked around in Paris that summer, and I remember, you know, the story in the book is I hung out with Kong Le, but the night that they landed on the moon. I spent a couple of days with Kong Le just because he was so happy to have somebody who would talk to him. But basically, I didn't get near the Pathet Lao or didn't achieve my goal whatsoever. You know, it was just a stupid thing on my part.
But then what happened?
Well, then I... You want to get into all that stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's all in the book.
I mean, yeah, but the thing is that Roger has an agenda.
Uh-huh.
He's formulating... When you're writing a monograph like this, you're formulating a vision. His vision is the bifurcation, or rather the absence of a single unified command in Laos. You could argue in Vietnam as well. And he even entertains the idea that had we had such a unified command, things could have turned out different. He doesn't say that himself. He lets people, in the concluding portions of the book, say, gee, if we'd only cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He doesn't entertain the idea that if we had put 250,000 men on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Saigon would have fallen right behind them. Well, we would have had men there too. Well, wait a minute. That's already 500,000. So now you've got the total we ended up having. Now, what if they resist us blocking the Ho Chi Minh Trail? That's another 500,000 to support that operation. The Pentagon always resisted that. The Pentagon always knew that they would never be allowed to block the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Wait, so what angle do you want me to
Well,
take
I wanted, I, he
I've got 20,
he
maybe we can get my interview, I did 25 hours with Roger.
Yeah, but with Roger, we get a narrative story,
right.
And it's one that he wants to put together to create this. We've got that, we don't want to, you're right, we don't have to go over that ground. But I think your impressions of American connection to the war, that's a secret war in Laos.
Right.
And your impressions as someone who'd been a volunteer, how you responded to that. You don't have to go through the story of going to the air command center.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
There, and that's amazing.
Right.
But rather how you slowly became aware of simply how serious American involvement in Laos was. As an IBSer, you knew something was going on.
Right.
Right?
Well, you know, none of us knew it because it wasn't until the Jacques Durquenois articles, which were done from the Pathet Lao zones, that the story of all these bombs flattening everything was told for the first time. And, you know, I had heard intimations of bombing and, you know, this, that, and the other, but, you know, I had no idea what they were even talking about, let alone the extent of it. I'm not sure the Americans on this side of the fence knew the extent of it, other than the people at Samtong, but it was when they brought the first refugees off the plane of jars down to the Vientiane plain that and people could talk to them, and every single one says he's lived underground for 5 years, that he starts, you know, from whatever village you talk to, that it was totally flattened. You know, that was when we all found out in September 69. You know.
And that led you to start an actual campaign of your own, air war of your own.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and now you're talking about it, I mean, you know, obviously this is related because, well, I certainly would have not gone to Laos without the, quote, cover of IBS for myself. So, I mean, I wouldn't have gone to Laos. That's an interesting point. I wouldn't have gone to Laos as an AID volunteer or an AID official, even though, I mean, somehow IBS just gave me just enough self-dignity that it was somehow a better thing to do than going to jail or going to Canada. Probably AID wouldn't have. That's an interesting point. So, you know, and because I was there, and, you know, they were, I mean, I wrote that up in, did you see that article I did about my visit to the Plain of Jars 25 years later?
No.
I'll give you that.
Oh, great.
That's one of my best pieces. The one of the points I made in there was that, you know, if I sit back and just don't look at it personally, it's like, do you need a Kleenex with
me? No. That, it's kind of a California allergy.
Okay.
Different plants that I'm not used to since I left.
That, you know, that, you know, Lewis Hershey had this idea that channeling, right, that people would be channeled into areas of natural. So the draft was not only good because it was getting all this raw fodder into the army, but it was channeling other people into areas of national service. So, you know, from a systems point of view, you know, given that there, let's say, whatever it might be, 8% of the American public at that point, or 12%, was, you know, strongly anti-war. You know, if you're channeling lots of people, you know, there's 1 out of 100 is going to be anti-war in Laos at that particular moment. I mean, you could sort of take the systems point of view, and one and will be like, you know, sort of horrified by it. But the fact is that what IBS did do for me was give me a besides the fig leaf of dignity to get me there, was give me the ability to live, even though I had to fight for it and fight Dr. Hall for it, but give me the ability to live close to the ground, learn the language, and really get to like the people. So without that, I mean, just the political impetus, for example, I've often thought, well, gee, you know, think of all the wars that have occurred since Laos that I haven't done anything about, you know, and it's not only that I don't have the credibility, but because I'm not there, I don't know much about it, but it's also, you know, besides psych-numbing and all the rest, I mean, basically, you know, in Laos, I got very closely identified with the people. It was a tremendous emotional fuel. I spoke the language. I loved them. You know, I totally identified with them, and you know, I had never met any group of people except for blacks that I actually liked in the world. Identify with. I certainly never thought of myself. I mean, at that point, I hated it. I was one of those people who spelled it with a K. I had nothing good to say about America during those years. So, you know, and I guess that part of that was, you know, is only possible in a group like IBS, that someone like me could wind up in the country and wind up going native. Ditto Don Luce. I mean, you can't imagine Don Luce as an AID official.
You mentioned in your you mentioned in the letter, I think, and also in the comments that you've made. I think there's some comments in there that it's in the letter that as long as IBS is an organization that sends young Americans to broaden their experience, to make cultural contacts, to expose people to other Americans than officials and soldiers, then it has a positive role to play.
Yeah, I would just like it to be separate at this point, as I think. Mm-hmm. Although, actually, I mean, we don't seem to be, we're certainly not, there will never be another Laos again, as far as we know. Certainly, I mean, that level of, I mean, the other thing about Laos is that, although maybe there wasn't a unified command, I mean, the CIA, there was a unified CIA command that was running a big part of that war. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, that was another big difference from why I think, I would argue that it would make sense to divide up IBS Vietnam and IBS Laos. That in IBS Vietnam, you were, so big, so huge, you weren't really under anybody exactly. I mean, you were under AID, but in Laos, you were part of that effort.
Yes.
Especially if you're in the rural development, I mean, the CIA were your bosses, in effect. I mean, they were setting the tune. Anyway, so yeah, I think I'd love to think that I caused them enough grief, that maybe it outweighed. I just went kind of nuts when these people was in the, for the next year and a half, well, for the next 5.5 years, it was just pure emotion on my part. I mean, there was rationality involved, there was a lot of other things, but basically I was pissed. I was horrified, and I just was angry for the next 5.5 years about it. If I get into that space, I could get angry right now. I was just pissed that we would bomb these lovely little people, and that was my basic thing. I just, just couldn't believe it. It totally blew my mind. So I just, had no game plan, no allies. I was on my own the whole time. I just was going to do, my life was organized around stopping it. Whatever I could do. I didn't know what I could do. That's just what it was.
And what was your feeling in 75 when the war came to an end?
I was delighted. Mm-hmm. I thought it was great. I thought the Viet Cong and Pathet Lao were going to walk in and create paradise on earth. It sort of led to my whole spiritual thing because at that point I had what I call an institutional analysis of society, that the problem was one set of institutions, and if you replace them with another set of institutions, things would get better. And, political forces and kind of whatever, and I've never been a Marxist thing. But I even read an article by Karl Marx, but I mean, sort of that basic idea of materialistic, objective, whatever. And then you see, to this day, it blows my mind to think that people who lived in the forest for 20, 30 years, on a handful of rice, and they never got near money, I mean, they're so pure, could be corrupted by money when they got to the city. I mean, it just never, frankly, never occurred to me. I used to have a fight all the time with the liberals about it. That was sort of my basic, after a while, the problem wasn't the conservatives anymore. They and I didn't even talk. I was the one always fighting with the liberals who'd say, well, the Royal Lao government is bad, but the Pathet Lao are worse. And my position was the Royal Lao government are bad, and the Pathet Lao would be better. Not perfect, but better. And I still think, I don't know enough to. I didn't stay long enough in Laos this time around to say, are they 1% better, 10% better, 50? I don't know. But basically, they're not that much better.
When you mentioned that the Royal Lao government was corrupt, from your experience, what was your perception of that corruption? Other than this example that the government seemed to service the needs of the rich and the well-connected, was there a sense that province chiefs had their hands in tills?
There wasn't a sense. There wasn't. It was, nobody would deny that. I mean, even the most pro, I mean, it's, you know, Uwe and Roddy Kuhn was, you know, selling opium that wound up in, I mean, the guy we're supporting was moving huge amounts of opium through Laos that was winding up poisoning, going to the veins of American soldiers in Vietnam. And it was even flying on American airplanes. That was the whole case of the Al McCoy book. And, you know, huge villas, and nobody denied it. I mean, it wasn't like that was a debate. Are the guys running the Royal Laos government stealing the country blind? That was not a debate. And even though, not that it makes it any better the path that Lowry doing it now, some of them anyway, but, you know, there is something a little obscene about doing it in the middle of a war. You know, when soldiers are dying and the generals aren't even worrying about the war and are over here stealing the money, I mean, that's a pretty grotesque. And that, I don't remember all those details now, but that was my world, and I was constantly, at that point, you know, I was filled with stories, you know, down to the nitty of, you know, General Reddy Coons, you know, this general, that general, what he would own and where the money was, and all the rest of it. And
what about any reflections on Von Powell?
That whole thing. I sure, you ought to talk to Ron Rickenbach. He's the real expert. I guess I went into that sharing his perception, but I mean, open to that point of view. But basically, he sees them as victims. The Mayo people were victims of Von Powell's megalomania, greed, and General Ahmed. And he wasn't a serious person. He may have been a serious, you know, very early on, but he was just another projection of everyone's imagination. They had to create some national leader to, you know, to justify what they were doing to themselves. Apparently this guy Bill Laird or Baird or whatever his name is, isn't that bad a guy, according to Roger, I don't know, maybe he's a good guy. And he liked Von Powell in the very beginning, but certainly by the time I was there, the stories of his concubines and his vicious treatment of people and his stealing money and his cowardice, his being willing. I mean, you know, you'd go up there and you'd see these young children playing, and there'd be like, you know, one boy and 10 girls, and the willingness to allow his people to be cannon fodder for the Americans out of pure megalomaniac. I mean, by the time I was there, I used to call them live bait. I mean, they weren't fighting. The reason they would send them into some area so they'd draw the path at Lao out, and then they try to bomb everybody. I mean, it wasn't serious. You can't talk about it. I mean, I wrote it all up in my presidential war in Laos in the McCoy book. But, I've never taken that whole thing seriously. I just,
you ever
except
read,
I felt sorry for the people.
Have you ever read Tragic Mountains, Jane Hamilton Merritt's?
I just think she was some right wing.
Well, it's not quite right wing. I mean, I know her quite well. I'm not bosom buddies. She's a, what do you call it? As you feel towards the Lao, she feels towards the Hmong, right. and she feels that Von Powell is a heroic figure, heroic in the sense that, you know, there are no pure, real heroic figures. This happens to be the Hmong's George Washington, so this is the one they have. She thinks McCoy has slandered him, and I think most people would agree that McCoy bears grudges and is not the world's most objective historian of that particular. He forces everything into that mold. He, by the way, wrote a nasty review of that book in the Journal of Asian Studies. McCoy should have instantly said, should have refused had he been offered that book to review, because his positions are so against what Merritt was saying. And instead, he asked for that book to review, and the editor, not realizing the controversy, let him do it. And this happens all the time in academic publishing, reviewing. And it's unbelievable. It's like, I don't have any analogies. It's like giving a Robert McNamara's book to Daniel Ellsberg review. That can be done in the Atlantic Monthly or anything, but you don't do it in an academic journal. Then you find someone who isn't directly connected with one school or another, but is knowledgeable about the area. And McCoy and Merritt were like asked. But anyway, I saw Von Powell about 2 months ago at a conference. Now, he gave a luncheon speech, which was unintelligible. is interesting to be in a very, very big room with.
I was wondering if he spoke English.
Speaking, no, he spoke. He spoke. He did not speak English, but he had translators.
Oh.
And that just doesn't work in a really big ballroom thing. You go on for maybe 40 minutes. But the best thing was there were two people. One was Pete Peterson, you know, he's the nominee as the first ambassador to Vietnam. He was a POW for 5 or 6 years, and his credentials are immaculate. But Jesse Helms is already blocking them. Now, imagine Jesse Helms trying to block the appointment of a POW as the first ambassador to Vietnam. It's terrible. But Peterson required a bodyguard there, and what amazed me was that there were death threats against a guy who had served 5 years in the Hanoi Hilton. And he's not safe in the United States because of right-wing politics.
Because he had agreed to be an ambassador?
Yeah, no, his problem was that he has been he says things like, I am surprised at the lack of confirmation that we have found for the accusation of the POW-MIA lobby. See, that's treason. To even say that, what you have to say is, by God, they're not giving us what we really need. See, like that. And because they keep getting information, but there's no confirmation because it's not there. You know, I mean, the first thing I would have done if I was Vietnamese is kill the last American I helped 5 or 6 years ago. Ten years ago when they realized they had to go capitalistic. They wouldn't want anything.
To call Bang Pao George Wan.
No, I'm not. I'm
so ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
No, I'm sure. Yeah. No, I mean, he was a primitive monster. I mean, he didn't.
Well, anyway, he required a bodyguard, according to himself. He had 30 armed men.
Bang Pao,
with sunglasses, you know, you thought you were in Saigon, this kind of thing.
Ridiculous. If he had any, by the time I was around there, you know, he should have just resigned, saved the people he could have saved, and, you know, gone home. I mean, obviously it wasn't going to
work. Well, it's gone on for a long time. I mean, the Bang Pao has actually encouraged people to stay, so you'll never make it in the United States. You know, a lot of Lao laugh at that, you know, because they have made it in the United States. I mean, a lot of Hmong, you know. But
if he was loved his people, he would not have. Even if you want to argue he did the right thing in the beginning, and a lot of people point out it was a much more of a tribal thing. Mm-hmm. It was to be Lee Fong, and he was from a different tribe, and all that. You know, just a lot of internal bullshit. Mm-hmm. But even if you want to argue he had a chance in the beginning, I just think by the time I was around, it was clear they were going to lose. I had no doubt about that. And
if the guy had any class at all, he would have
just resigned. Well, and they say whenever he tried to resign, the Americans wouldn't let him. That's what I was hearing. I had put that in my book, that they were threatening to kill him. That's the reason he kept the war going. So he thought he didn't have that option.
Yes, well, now, of course, there are rumors of corruption and the use of money that they raised from the Lao community. Community in the United States, that it's not being spent properly for the refugees. But there's been controversy, should the United States be complicit in forcibly repatriating Hmong to Laos where they may end up at a reservation or something. Well, here, look, I've got this book.
Okay.
You have to sign it.
Alrighty.
Conclude this, you'll hand me the tape recorder. We'll conclude this this portion.
I've got to come back into the area in about a month.
Okay.
And I'll give you a call.